Thank you, Mary, Rosalind, Pat, for making this possible, for inviting me here and sticking up for me. There was, as everybody knows, no shortage of pressure to cancel me, to besiege this organization to the point where certain facts could not be discussed in public. And you stuck up for a perspective that often isn't heard in Washington, at least within chambers and buildings controlled by the two parties. I want to talk about all sorts. There's so much to talk about, and I don't have time. I want to talk about what really happened on October 7th, why October 7th happened, why Gaza is in the situation it's in. I want to talk about anti-Semitism. I also want to talk about Ukraine and what's happening there. There just isn't time. What I really want to talk about is the Democrats. I mean, I think that's the appropriate thing to discuss here, because there is a crisis in the Democratic Party, and everybody knows it, no matter what you think about Israel-Palestine. And you're going to hear my perspective on it, why it's happening, and who the problem is. I want to just to tell you a little bit more about myself, apart from the bio that you heard. I am the only person in America who was condemned by both major candidates in 2016, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton's campaign, both condemned me for my, yes. Huge badge of honor. David Friedman, the reciprocal ambassador to Israel in the U.S. under Donald Trump, can't really tell which country he represented, condemned me as the biggest anti-Semite in the world. And Hillary Clinton also condemned me in a statement written by Jake Sullivan, who is now National Security Council director. So I'm very proud of that distinction. It's for the work that I've been doing for all these years inside Palestine, inside occupied Palestine, inside Israeli-controlled territory, producing several books, a documentary with Dan Cohen, Killing Gaza, my book Goliath, which is really a profile of Israeli society, spending off and on 5 years there, really seeing from within Jewish Israeli society how it was all building up to this moment, how that society was being primed for a genocide. And my book, The 51-Day War, about the assault on Gaza that killed 2,200 people, just left 100,000 people homeless, 35,000 artillery shells piled onto Gaza, 40,000 tank shells, all supplied by Barack Obama. That really set the stage for what we're experiencing now. And so I saw this coming. And now all of you know 30,000 are officially dead in Gaza since October 7th. 17,000 children orphaned, over 80,000 injured. These are just official conservative statistics. The conservative number is that 2% of the population of Gaza has been killed. That's conservative. The health ministry in Gaza, because the entire health system has been put out of service. The head of Al-Shifa Hospital, because he refused to allow Israeli soldiers to attack his hospital, is now being tortured in an Israeli prison, Mohammed Al-Suleiman. They can't keep the numbers, so we don't know how many people are trapped under the rubble. We know people are now starving in northern Gaza. Israel dropped flyers on northern Gaza today saying, have a happy Ramadan and don't forget to feed the needy. An act of psychological warfare to torture people who are being deliberately starved. And 15 children yesterday starved to death at Kamal Adwan Hospital. I can go on and on with the statistics. We're in Washington. I was talking just an hour ago to a journalist in northern Gaza named Mohammed Salem. He sent me photographs of his, I wanted to hear about the humanitarian situation, and he sent me photographs of his two daughters who had just been killed, his teenage daughters, and his son who's lost his foot. He was badly burned in an Israeli assault. And I've been following the Twitter account of our colleague in Gaza, in northern Gaza, a journalist like me, Motassem Dalul, who has been going out every day to try to get a bag of flour for his family, because his family has been starving like all of his neighbors. His elderly neighbor died last week of dehydration. And he's been witnessing the attacks by the Israelis on the aid convoys. And on the day, I believe it was last week, when he finally secured a bag of flour for his hungry kids, he came home to see that Israel had attacked his home, killed his daughter, killed his pregnant wife, and wounded his son, who survived. These are our colleagues. My colleague and friend, Rifat Alarir, who I met in 2013, a poet, a professor of English at Islamic University, was one of my heroes, and I was following his Twitter account avidly throughout this assault on Gaza. Rifat was the first professor at Islamic University, a university founded by Hamas, to teach Hebrew literature. He also taught The Merchant of Venice and encouraged his students to sympathize not with Othello, the Moorish general, but with Shylock, the persecuted Jew who had to compromise his dignity in order to survive in an anti-Semitic society. And his students said that they, as Palestinians, identified with Shylock, the Jew. Rifat brought anti-Zionist Jews to his class and told them, "I used to be an anti-Semite until I met these Jews in America who are organizing against our occupation and our oppression. Now I see things differently. The issue is Zionism." And he taught his students to resist by not being extremists, but by being intellectuals and succeeding inside Gaza, inside this open-air prison. Rifat was hunted down by the Israeli authorities. His direct messages on Twitter were filling with threats from active duty Israeli soldiers pledging to kill him and his family in December. He fled from a shelter with his family after receiving a phone call from the Israeli military telling him that they planned to bomb his location, that they had tracked him on his cell phone, and went home to his sister's house, where they attacked his home with a missile and killed him and his entire family. Rifat's last tweet, was "The Democratic Party and Biden are responsible for the Gaza genocide committed by Israel." Today in the Democratic Party, figures like Jesse Jackson, who expressed sympathy for Palestinians, who attempted to open lines of freelance diplomacy with the PLO, which the US government eventually did, who also helped get American hostages released from Syria through his connections with all of these governments that were declared rogue by the US State Department, or George Ball, Assistant Secretary of State, who would challenge LBJ on his Vietnam War policy day after day, who authored the book A Passionate Attachment, about America's destructive special relationship with Israel. Even Jack Kennedy, who called for Jerusalem to be an international city under the management of the UN, and who, in one of his final speeches at the American University, warned of the consequences of a Cold War and urged his constituents to put themselves in the shoes of the people of Russia, the people of the Soviet Union, they wouldn't be welcome in today's Democratic Party. I'm not welcome. I might be welcome by you, but I'm not welcome by the party, the people who decide who gets elected. The party is run by what I would call, they're not by anti-war Democrats or progressive Democrats, but by genocide Democrats. They might pay lip service to Black Lives Matter, claim to support women's or children's rights. Hillary Clinton said she's a major advocate of children's rights. They say they oppose Christian nationalism and religious nationalism at home. But when AIPAC comes calling, they sacrifice all of those principles and they bow to apartheid. Let's look at Biden himself. Joe Biden is the largest recipient of Israel lobby money of any active US politician. He's received over $1 million throughout his career. He identifies himself as a Christian or Gentile Zionist. He said in a floor speech in the Senate that if Israel did not exist, it would have to be invented. We would have to invent it. The way we kind of did. In 1982, Joe Biden shocked the hardline Likudnik Prime Minister Menachem Begin during a closed session of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when Begin had just invaded Lebanon. All the senators on the committee were badgering Begin, declaring, "How could you do this? You're destabilizing the Middle East." And Biden was the lone senator to support him, but he actually shocked Begin when he said, "I would go even further than you. I would be willing to kill women and children." That's according to a new book by Alex B. Ward called The Internationalists. And this incident was described by none other than Begin himself. Nothing could display the control that Israel's regime and its lobbying apparatus has over Joe Biden than the pathetic and hypocritical scene of the U.S. military dropping a few parcels of aid over the Gaza Strip where people are starving, with barely enough food for a block of people to survive on, while they are funneling thousands and thousands of tank shells and 155-millimeter howitzers directly through the air bridge established by Biden to Israel. No, they're not allowed. They're not allowed to deliver aid directly to Gaza. They're not allowed to bring naval ships there. This superpower, the most powerful country in the history of the world, is not allowed to bring aid to end hunger. USAID Chief Samantha Power, the guru of the R2P, Responsibility to Protect Anti-Genocide Industry, has become a genocide Democrat as USAID director, and her staff is in open revolt against her covering up the killing of a USAID contractor by Israel in Gaza. Samantha Power attacked, slammed Clinton administration officials, including Susan Rice, for their failure to speak up and do something about the Rwanda genocide. What is she doing as people starve, as 570,000 people are on the brink of famine in Gaza, according to the United Nations? Where is she? She's posing for photo ops in Jordan with aid that she admits on her Twitter account will never see its way into the Gaza Strip. And she will not quit her position. She will not speak up. She will not publicly attack her boss. She is a hypocrite. They could end it right now. They could end this starvation, this famine right now if they wanted. All Joe Biden has to do is make a phone call to Netanyahu. He's been on the phone with him every day. He's so frustrated. They're always leaking all these conversations. Oh, Netanyahu won't do what we want. By the way, we're sending more weapons. All you have to do is say no more spare parts for the F-16s that are bombing all those multifamily story apartment blocks in Gaza that have destroyed 85% of all residential buildings in the Gaza Strip. No more parts, no more howitzers, time to negotiate. And by the way, once we have a ceasefire, the hostages will all come out and they can all be on the White House lawn in a big ceremony with you. And Tony Blinken can get the accolade he deserves for getting the hostages out. Why don't they do it? They can't do it because Biden wants to run for re-election. Biden is Mr. AIPAC. Joe Biden, instead of listening and responding to the voices of the 100,000 people who voted uncommitted in Michigan, went to the home of Haim Saban, a Zionist billionaire Hollywood mogul, who said that I'm a one-issue guy and my issue is Israel. Haim Saban hosted a $250,000 a head fundraiser for Biden, helping Biden raise a record total of $42 million in January alone, co-hosted by pro-Israel Hollywood mogul Casey Wasserman. And that's why the aid isn't getting in. That's why Biden will not counter Netanyahu and the most right-wing, fanatically religious, nationalist, anti-Palestinian coalition government in Israeli history. This isn't just limited to Biden. Bill and Hillary Clinton, remember them? They earned $3.5 million by 2016 in paid speeches by Israel lobby groups. That's along with $153 million in lecture fees from companies and organizations affiliated with the financial industry. After leaving office, Clinton promptly blamed Yasser Arafat for the failure of negotiations, explicitly violating a promise he made to Arafat in order to get Arafat to the negotiating table at Camp David. The former President Clinton thus reinforced then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who moved more settlements into the West Bank, more settlers than any other prime minister, his infamous talking point that there was no partner for peace. Then in the summer of 2002, the Vietnam draft dodger Bill Clinton declared at the Toronto chapter of the pro-Israel group Hadassah World Zionist Organization, this is what Bill Clinton said: "If Iraq came across the Jordan River, I would grab a rifle and get in the trench and fight and die for Israel." And he earned wild applause with this line at the $1,000 a plate dinner. Bill Clinton earned $125,000 for that speech. Hillary Clinton, one of the largest recipients as a senator of donations from AIPAC, has slammed proposals for a ceasefire in Gaza, repeatedly supported Israel's military campaign in Gaza, consistent with her passion for regime change wars. It was Hillary Clinton, under the watch of Barack Obama, who helped destroy Libya, assassinating its leader, sending weapons to Al-Qaeda-allied proxies like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, flooding Libya with weapons, leading to the rise of ISIS, ISIS control over several cities in Syria, the destabilization of the entire Sahel region, and the return of slavery to the African continent. As the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi warned, today Libya is a despotic hellhole in crisis thanks to that military intervention, and the destabilization continues. Hillary Clinton called to bomb Syria in 2016. She also called for directly confronting Russian aircraft, going to war with Russia over Syria in 2016, becoming the air force for Al-Qaeda, the forces that the U.S. was arming on the ground there to overthrow the Syrian government. And of course, she spread the lies about WMD in Iraq in her notorious Senate floor speech supporting the war on Iraq. Where are the women and children's rights that she stood for her life when it comes to women in Gaza, who now have nowhere to even have their periods, have their children, whose children are being exterminated before their eyes? Where are the children's rights? Children have nowhere to hide in Gaza. The hypocrisy is stunning, as it was with Barack Obama, who was himself a recipient of hundreds of thousands of dollars of money from AIPAC by the time he was elected president after spending just a short time in the Senate. Well, I remember when Barack Obama was elected, before he was inaugurated, that's when Israel chose to launch the beginning of its succession of devastating assaults on Gaza, Operation Cast Lead, which left over 1,400 dead, 40,000 homes destroyed, and 100,000 homeless. And Obama said nothing about Operation Cast Lead. And when he was inaugurated, he sent the GBU bunker buster bombs, the 2,000-pound bombs, the howitzers, the tank shells. Barack Obama presided over the grisliest assaults on Gaza up until this point, Operation Pillar of Defense, over 150 killed, 300 homes destroyed, 1,700 left homeless, Operation Protective Edge, which I covered from the inside of Gaza. I saw it. I witnessed the destruction. I sat with those whose families were slaughtered. I sat in their destroyed homes. 2,200 killed, 17,000 families left homeless, families, not people, 35,000 artillery shells of different types fired on Gaza after being delivered by the Obama administration, and 14,500 tank shells. What's Obama doing now? Has he said anything about this? Is he speaking out like Jimmy Carter so bravely did? Is he even like building homes for the homeless like Jimmy Carter did? No. His life is one giant luxury vacation. He's one week he's at a Springsteen concert, Michelle's playing tambourine. The next week he's having splash fights with billionaire Richard Branson at his private mansion. He's raking in the multi-million dollar speaking fees from the big banks as the Clintons did. And he, like the Clintons and like Joe Biden's largest single donor, was Haim Saban, the one issue guy whose issue is Israel. Who controls Biden's foreign policy? Is it Biden? Do you feel like he's in charge? Do you feel like he's, I don't know, the independent solicitor from the Justice Department said he wasn't really in charge enough to know about his own son's dealings with Burisma. So I wonder if he actually is capable of standing up to a cunning figure like Netanyahu. Tony Blinken's the man in charge. Tony Blinken is not just the Secretary of State. He's a veteran Democratic operative who forfeited all diplomatic leverage that the United States might have had over Israel in this conflict when he announced on his first trip to Israel that he was there, quote, as a Jew. Can you imagine a Muslim diplomat from the U.S. going to a country like Pakistan and declaring he's there as a Muslim? What would happen to him or her? It would be a disaster. But Tony Blinken has been using this language throughout his career in order to get himself to where he is. Tony Blinken comes from Israel lobby royalty. His grandfather, Nathan, authored an influential study in the 1930s on the feasibility of Zionist colonization of Palestine. Those were the words, the language he used in his study. He sponsored the study. Tony Blinken's father-in-law, the man who raised him, was Samuel Pissar, who was himself a kind of pro-Israel fixer for François Mitterrand in France. And he was the consigliere for Robert Maxwell, a Mossad agent who you all probably know well. Robert Maxwell's last call before he notoriously fell or mysteriously fell off his yacht in the Mediterranean was to Tony Blinken's father-in-law, Samuel Pissar. Robert Maxwell was given a de facto state burial in Israel, and his daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, earned infamy as Jeffrey Epstein's wingwoman. Jeffrey Epstein, another person with unsavory ties, likely unsavory ties to Israeli intelligence. At a 2007 AIPAC meeting, Tony Blinken declared that he inherited his, quote, commitment to Israel's strength through his family. And this has been the language and the politics that he's used to climb the ladder in the Beltway. Right now, there is a protest encampment outside Tony Blinken's home. It's a 24/7 protest encampment. They're there rain or shine. I visited them 2 days ago. It was muddy. They were there in the mud. One of the women is a Palestinian refugee who actually experienced the Nakba in 1948. And they protest any time Blinken's motorcade goes in or out, demanding a ceasefire. All they want is a ceasefire, and then they will leave. And they're outside a big mansion. I mean, he lives across the street from a home that was purchased by an LLC for $40 million. Just to give you an idea of the wealth in Tony Blinken's bank account, where did it come from? It came from, in many ways, a company called West Exec Advisors, where the Obama foreign policy team cooled their heels during the Trump administration. West Exec Advisors markets itself as a boutique consulting firm, and what they do is they help shepherd deals, hump in deals for the arms industry, for spy tech firms. Jen Psaki, who's now an MSNBC host, former press secretary, she got a deal through West Exec to consult for an Israeli spy tech company. And they would use their connections to make money for the arms industry, the spying industry, the same industries that are cashing in on the assault on Gaza and the Ukraine proxy war, which Tony Blinken and his team are supporting. Then you have Victoria Nuland. Well, before I get to Victoria Nuland, there's someone I've had direct encounters with, Matthew Miller at the State Department. He's the guy who's basically up there defending the Gaza policy of the Biden administration, which is to drop a few packages of aid in with one hand and drop thousands of bombs with the other, to put it crudely. Matthew Miller is the former spokesman for Robert Menendez, who is right behind Joe Biden as a historically top recipient of AIPAC money because he was the chair and ranking chair on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In fact, Bob Menendez's legal defense during his first corruption trial when he got off was funded by pro-Israel donors. Now Bob Menendez is going to jail for taking literal gold bars in his pockets from Egyptian lobbyists. The pro-Israel lobbyists were more elegant about it. Victoria Nuland has just resigned. She was Tony Blinken's underling assistant secretary of state. She's the former chief of staff to the great Democratic Party hero, Dick Cheney. What? Yeah, she served in Republican Democratic administration. She is a arch neoconservative whose husband, Robert Kagan, wrote the Benevolent Hegemony essay with Bill Kristol, who is now supporting the genocide Democrats through his various front organizations, which called for the United States to act as a benevolent dictator and take out rogue governments across the world, paving the path for the invasion of Iraq with its eyes on Iran. Victoria Nuland just resigned, leaving behind a legacy of the architect of the 2014 coup, which removed an elected president in Kiev and installed a US and NATO-backed government, paving the primrose path, as John Mearsheimer put it, to war with Russia. Victoria Nuland was famously recorded in a leaked recording deciding who would come into power after the Ukrainian government was removed in a color revolution. Give Yats the attaboy, she said about billionaire Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and we'll keep Klitsch on the outside, referring to Vitaly Klitschko, who's now mayor of Kiev. She essentially controlled what happened in Ukraine after she handed out cookies in the Maidan Square with the US ambassador, Jeffrey Piat, to protesters who wanted a better Ukraine and rioters. I'm being told this is time. Well, I'm going to go 2 minutes over time and just talk about congressional leadership a little bit, because we have a historic person in Congress, Hakeem Jeffries, the first black congressional minority leader to bow before an apartheid state. Hakeem Jeffries is also one of the top recipients of AIPAC money. He's the son of a black radical named Leonard Jeffries. In 1992, Hakeem Jeffries published an op-ed for his college newspaper denouncing Clarence Thomas and Colin Powell as, quote, house Negroes and token blacks propped up by racist, affluent elements. Hey, I don't think any of us would argue with that. He even quoted Augusto Sandino, the Nicaraguan guerrilla leader who resisted the U.S. Marine invasion of his country, to paint the U.S. military as the policemen of Wall Street bankers. Fully agree with old Hakeem Jeffries. But 30 years later, Hakeem Jeffries, in a speech before a pro-Israel organization, unwittingly but appropriately channeled the segregationist former Alabama governor George Wallace, declaring Israel today, Israel tomorrow, Israel forever. Did he know he was quoting Wallace's most infamous statement? Clarence Thomas and Hakeem Jeffries are different, but who's more dangerous? Clarence Thomas revels in liberal America's contempt. He likes being called a house Negro by Democrats. He hates them. But Jeffries, he mimics the rhetorical techniques of Jesse Jackson and caters aggressively to the social concerns of the Democratic Party's donor class, not the grassroots. And in this way, he and many of his colleagues are arguably more effective than Clarence Thomas in serving what Hakeem Jeffries once described as an elite business class through the promotion of multinational corporations and the military complex. And look at what AIPAC will do to black members of Congress and black politicians who don't toe their line. They will destroy them like they destroyed Nina Turner in Ohio. Look at what they tried to do to Donna Edwards here right out in Prince George's County because she simply called for a Palestinian state. Look at what they plan to do to Jamal Bowman and Ilhan Omar. Nancy Pelosi was the predecessor of Hakeem Jeffries. She was protested at her home for her support for Israel's military assault on Gaza and refused an objection to a ceasefire. And what did she tell those protesters? That they are controlled by Russia and that their headquarters is located in China. This is not just tragic, it's criminal. And if South African lawyers who have prepared a filing against many of these elected officials who are presiding over this genocide have their way, they could go to trial. These are the genocide Democrats. And if AIPAC has its way in this election cycle, they will elect many, many more of these kind of figures while crushing any iteration of anti-war politics in the Democratic Party. They are unveiling a $100 million war chest, which will partly be spent through Democrats for a pro-Israel majority, which is one of its leaders has condemned this event, Ann Lewis. And then what are we left with? Are we left with a party worth supporting? Is there anything worth supporting there? I see this event as part of a wider rebellion in the party grassroots. I see it in Michigan, where 100,000 people voted uncommitted. In Minnesota, where 20% of all voters voted uncommitted in protest of the Gaza genocide. In Los Angeles, where Jewish Voices for Peace interrupted Adam Schiff's victory party. Took over Adam Schiff's victory party. These are people who won't stand for the Democratic Party being a party of genocide Democrats. And look at how they're being attacked. They're being attacked for playing purity politics, for something boutique. No, this is the moral issue of our time. This is the Holocaust of our time. This is the Trail of Tears of our time. This is the Middle Passage of our time. And what we are doing now to oppose it will be written in the annals of history, and it will say everything about us. You know what? This has to continue into Chicago. It has to continue into November. As long as this assault continues, and as long as these policies of supporting apartheid continue, then they must feel the heat. If, like me, you can't stand this, if you stand with the starving, the homeless, the dispossessed in Gaza, you must not let the genocide Democrats win. Thank you. Thank you.
The first question, Max, thank you, is what policies would you advocate for the U.S. to take toward Israel? How can we achieve a two-state solution?
Everybody can boycott Israeli products and cultural institutions, as Palestinian civil society has been asking since 2005 or 2007, since the ICJ decision against the apartheid wall in and around the West Bank. They can organize divestment drives on their campuses and their businesses. This is something everyone can do to create pressure, the same pressure that was put on apartheid South Africa, to make South Africa into a country that the world would welcome into the actual international community. But sanctions is something that only a government can do. And what needs to happen is sanctions need to be imposed at the United Nations, not unilaterally, and I would call for the U.S. to support those sanctions on Israel until it ends its system of apartheid. And this is why, it's not just the refusal of the U.S. to do that, it's the diplomatic cover that we see the U.S. providing alone on the UN Security Council, the isolation that it has brought to Palestinians, the opposition of the Obama administration to even Palestinian observer status at the UN, this kind of treatment and abuse of Palestinians that denied the government in Gaza any diplomatic channels and led to October 7th, which was rooted in political motivations and which led to bloodshed and awful events. In order to establish diplomatic leverage, the only thing a Palestinian group that is not allowed to be a government like Hamas has is the ability to take captives. They showed it when they got Gilad Shalit. It was the first time they'd ever achieved any diplomatic leverage, and they got over 1,000 prisoners out, an Israeli soldier named Gilad Shalit, and he came out alive. That's why October 7th happened. So when you start pushing Israel, you start removing the motivation for more October 7th. The U.S. thinks it can be solved the way they destroyed Libya, the way they decimated Syria, the way they are destroying countries across Latin America through a regime change operation, and we know that that will fail, and that Hamas will not be eradicated through this assault.
Thanks, Max. A member asked this question. This is sort of a combined question. Do you feel that Trump would be better at the issues and problems you discussed?
Well, that's the feeling of hopelessness and voicelessness that a lot of people in the grassroots, who are mostly progressive, feel, is that there is not an alternative within the other party. Trump is just as much, he's a genocide Republican. Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, is going to be back in the White House with a security clearance, and we know where that will lead. And we heard Trump's statement, finish them off, which is the same thing Nikki Haley said about Gaza, finish them. These are like poll-tested, focus group-tested phrases that work among the Republican grassroots, which is substantially populated by Christian Zionists, people who are passionate about Israel because it's the future landing pad of the Messiah. So I don't see any hope within the Republican Party's leadership. What I can say is things are changing among younger evangelicals. They have actually organized actions in the West Bank called Christ at the Checkpoint to protest Israel's occupation. Even younger Mormons are becoming sympathetic to Palestine. Look at all the polls. So these dynamics are going to ultimately shift politics, but people feel like Republicans feel like the 2020 election was rigged. I think people feel that there's just a general rigging. It's not through ballot boxes being stuffed, miscounted. It's through wealthy, powerful, pro-war elements dominating politics and everyone being voiceless.
Thanks, Max. This from another member. Are you going to vote in the election? And how might you vote? And how did Obama become such a friend of Israel after his speech in Cairo in his first term?
I'm going to vote for Dr. Shiva. No, I'm joking. But I figured a few people would get that. I'm not going to discuss how I vote. I don't endorse candidates. I did a talk at Busboys and Poets in Tacoma Park with Jill Stein of the Green Party, who's going to be on the ballot in more than 40 states. She performed very well. And, you know, that's someone Biden's going to have to pay attention to if he's going to uphold this line on Gaza. There were like two questions. How did Obama, the die had already been cast with Obama. And if you look back at his Cairo speech, it was sort of an effort to try to mollify and co-opt Arab public opinion in support of a larger agenda that wasn't going to play out with respect to Israel-Palestine, and which the Arab Spring kind of took off the table. But it was to sort of establish, you look at what they did in Egypt. It's a big success for U.S. diplomacy. A country of 80 million people, which was the powerhouse, not just of the Arab economies, but also of Arab politics, which was led by someone who supported Arab resistance, was turned into a U.S. protectorate run by a military that's totally dependent on U.S. aid through Camp David. And Obama wanted to do the same thing with the Palestinians through the Palestinian Authority. And that's what Cairo is about. It's about turning the Arab world into Jordan or Egypt. And look at what look at the crisis this helped create. Egypt's building a wall on the southern border of Gaza so that starving, desperate people cannot get out when Israel comes to assault them. And they'll be stuck between a literal rock and a hard place.
These are Zoom questions.
Yeah, we have a question from somebody on Zoom who's asking, of course war is horrible, so why did the Palestinians initiate this war with their vicious attack on Israelis on October 7th?
Well, they didn't.
What do you mean they didn't?
They didn't. This war has been going on for 75 years. Israel initiated it in 1948 by ethnically cleansing 750,000 people. We must expel Arabs.
Get out of here.
We must expel Arabs and take their places.
And are we all Democrats here? Are we all Democrats? I'm leaving. Yes, Ryan. Ryan's true. Leaving, and I will never be back. This is not a Democrat.
Okay.
Don't kill any more babies tonight, okay?
Is the U.S.
We must expel Arabs and take their places. And if we have to use force, not to dispossess the Arabs of the Negev and Transjordan, but to guarantee our own right to settle in those places, then we have force at our disposal. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, said that in 1937. And that's what they proceeded to do. The people in Gaza This is what you need to understand. The people in Gaza, over 80% of them are refugees. Many of them are from a place called Majdal Ascalon in what is now southern Israel, in a city called Ashkelon. And they were dragged from their homes and driven from their homes, placed in prison camps, barbed wire prison camps, and then dumped in trucks in 1950 into the Gaza Strip where they would be permanently warehoused. And then Israel proceeded to move Arab, Jewish refugees and Russians into Ashkelon to prevent them from ever coming back, and pass laws to prevent Arabs, Palestinians from being able to return to their homes. 750,000 were ethnically cleansed. For 18 years, the remaining Palestinians, 100,000 were internally displaced inside Israel. The remaining were put under military rule. They were under military occupation until 1966. Then in 1967, Israel violently, in a war it initiated, occupies Gaza, occupies the West Bank, occupies the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights in East Jerusalem, and then invades Lebanon in 1982, attacking Palestinian refugees there, puts Gaza under siege in 2005. No one can get in or out without Israeli military permission. We must kill and kill all day, every day. That's according to Arnon Sofer, an Israeli government consultant who helped devise the siege of Gaza. For years, Israel would not allow certain chocolates and A2 paper into Gaza. And then they began these brutal military assaults, which they call mowing the lawn. Slaughtering a few people will leave Hamas intact, but teach them a lesson. And I talked to you about those assaults that took place on Gaza. So this didn't come out of a vacuum. You're not going to be able to hold people under siege, didn't cut them off from the world, and then expect them to just play along. That doesn't mean that I celebrate what happened on October 7th. It should have never had to happen. The reason it happened is because of the Israel lobby here, the genocide Democrats and the genocide Republicans who deny the Palestinians any right to have rights. And it's the right to have rights that defines you as a citizen. They're citizens of nothing. And now we see what Israel really thinks of them, really thinks of their children. Gaza has become a graveyard for children, according to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. So this didn't start on October 7th, and it's not going to end when there's a ceasefire.
Max, about Gaza, what would Trump do if he were president, and what would the Republicans have done if they were in control?
Well, I think it would be similar. Trump said that he would say that he wants to smash Gaza, but I don't think he would be able to do anything different. I don't think there's anything Biden has done that exercised any U.S. leverage. Trump wouldn't either. But what we do know about Donald Trump is that he went rogue in many ways and went off script. There's a script that's handed to you when you come into the White House. It's the script Biden has been reading from his entire career, and Trump refused to follow it. He first refused to follow it at the Republican Jewish Coalition of Sheldon Adelson, who works with Haim Saban. He's dead, but his wife still runs his foundation. They control the Republican Party through donations. He was Trump's top donor. Before Adelson was donating to Trump, Trump said at this meeting, "You guys are real estate, you're in real estate. You know how to make deals. I think we can make a deal between Israel and Palestine." And then they called Trump an anti-Semite for saying that. And then he signs on with the Adelson agenda, the Jared Kushner agenda. The rest is history. But Trump tried to broker peace on the Korean Peninsula. That was a heroic act. 80% of Koreans support peace, while the Democratic Party establishment attacked him and mocked him for doing that. People want to have their families reunited there. He sat down to discuss reducing intermediate ballistic missile stocks with Vladimir Putin, and CNN published a story claiming that Putin handed him a soccer ball with a hidden mic inside to spy on the president. And Rachel Maddow, night after night, said Trump was going to be impeached and arrested for his ties to Vladimir Putin. This is how it was received. This is how peacemaking and diplomacy was received. So Trump, when he comes back in, is going to be under even more pressure than he was before to read from the Beltway script. And I don't know why anyone was laughing about peace in Korea, because anyone in Korea, except for a few fanatics in the South, wants to see the peninsula united and wants to end this war, which was itself a U.S. genocide, in which the North Korean population lost 20% of their population. Curtis LeMay, who was in charge of the aerial bombardment operation that leveled Pyongyang to the ground, said if we had lost the war, we would have been all tried as war criminals.
Max, this is our last question. It's, okay, it is 7 o'clock, but thank you very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.